Now back to Rintoul and Surman.
So you've got a power forward, the two centers, a specialist forward, the shutdown defenseman, the puck-moving defenseman, and then the elite goalie. And then you build around those players, and you can be very cap-friendly. And that formula really works with any kind of market team, not just big market, not medium market, not small market. It works with any team.
That, of course, was Pierre McGuire. He is back in the NHL after 25 years or so away, being a broadcaster, of course, with the three-letter station, TSN, up here in Canada, and then with NBC, ESPN, Turner not deciding to go with Pierre McGuire as part of their broadcast teams, Jamie. So he is now the new Senior VP of Player Development with the Ottawa Senators. You are listening to Rintoul and Surman. Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott Rintoul. Scott will be back on the other side tomorrow. We haven't talked about the bet. We will as the show goes on, Jamie, but Scott was pretty good. Yesterday, he did text me because he was a little worried he wasn't going to be able to watch the match because he wasn't going to have a television in front of him, and he was unsure if he'd have, you know, Wi-Fi or LTE or 5G wherever he was so that he could watch streaming on an iPad, an iPhone, or any sort of smartphone, I should say. But he did get to watch the match, and basically all he said to me was condolences. He took the high
well,
road.
There you go.
Took the...
Yeah, that, I mean, that look, that's that sounds like Scotty taking the high road. I wasn't expecting him to rub it in too much on you, you know. And, I mean, let's be honest. How much of an Italian fan is Scotty, really? Like, come on. I mean, is he a diehard Italian fan? I don't know. So I expected him to take it pretty gentle on you.
Well, I do think his grandmother, who recently had passed away, he said God bless her soul the last time she was on. So I think that he was pretty much cheering for them for her. So I completely understand. My English roots go, I think, 4 or 5. Like, basically, as long as you can do my family tree,
sure.
I've got English roots. I don't know any of my relatives in England. I only know the ones that are over here in Canada, and all of them were born. All of my relatives here in Canada were born in Canada, but I do jump on the England bandwagon, of course, and yeah, I've got that bet I'm going to have to do at some point. I'm kind of psyching myself up to do it, but we got to talk about the news of the day, because before we get to Pierre McGuire and we just heard from him, let's talk about the fact that as we were on the phone with Mark Spector, who got a phone from Elliot Freeman when it went down, that Duncan Keith and talks with the Edmonton Oilers are finally starting to progress. It still may take some time, Elliot says, but progression was made over the weekend. Mark Spector then tweeted out, Holland left this deal with Bowman a week ago and will assume Bowman could not find any other alternative suitors. Caleb Jones' name is still in this trade. That's what Mark is suggesting. I'm actually surprised that I actually heard this news today. I really did think that Stan Bowman saw Duncan Keith at a level that Ken Holland was not willing to pay. I honestly did. And when I saw that and the fact that Holland didn't need to necessarily make this move or, you know, mortgage a future assets to get this player in, I thought that Holland was just going to walk away and say no. But I guess he's been able to stand firm on the deal that he wants to give Stan Bowman. And I do question, Jamie, if some of this has to do with some cap retention for Chicago as well, because of the fact that we do know that, yeah, it's a 5.75 salary cap hit for Duncan Keith, but he is owed, I believe it's a lot more money next season. I have to go look at that, but I do wonder if there is some salary retention in this deal.
It's going to be really interesting to see the details of the deal when they do eventually come out, and it does sound like, you know, Friedman's not reporting it's a done deal, but he's expecting it to get done. Might take a couple days still, but eventually we will find out the details here of this trade. Go ahead.
Just quickly here. No, just quickly. Yeah, like the base salary, total salary is only 2.1, so he's not owed more real money. I was thinking of Vladimir Tarasenko. But yes, it's a 5.538 cap space, so you do wonder if they're retaining not just salary, but cap space. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what it's going to come down to. And, I mean, ultimately, as Mark Spector told us just, you know, half an hour ago or so, Chicago's hands were kind of tied here, right? Because you have a player who's a legend in your organization who's decided he wants to go elsewhere. He controls his destiny, right? He has a no-move clause. Basically, it's given you four teams, and it sounds like three of those teams aren't interested, right? Seattle, Vancouver, Calgary, for various reasons, none of them really wanted to go down that road. That leaves you with only Edmonton. That's a really tough spot for Chicago to be in. So it doesn't surprise me that much that they ended up circling back, and probably they've bent a little bit on their demands, and they've acceded to what Edmonton is asking for or what Edmonton is willing to give up. I'm not too surprised, but I am going to be very interested in exactly what Edmonton has to give back to Chicago here? Because I agree. I mean, when Spector was on, he said, you know, initially Chicago was asking for Ethan Bear. It's like, no, get out of here. There's no way I'm making that deal if I'm Edmonton. But I do think there is still a role for Duncan Keith to play on an NHL team. It's just a question of how much of a cap hit is it going to take, and what are you giving back going back the other way, right? If it's a small price and you're getting a break on its cap hit, yeah, I think he can do something for Edmonton.
And when you look at the Oilers' defense right now, you've got that top bearing of basically Darnell Nurse and Ethan Bear, and then someone to play with Adam Larson. Then you've got Caleb Jones and Evan Bouchard. Like, do you go young on that? You've also got Chris Russell that, you know, he's at least a veteran guy that can step in on the third pairing. He'll block a lot of shots for you, Jamie, and he can play on the penalty kill as well. So it'll be good to see. It's, you know, Duncan Keith not having to play in the top power play, or sorry, the top unit, defensive unit in Edmonton. You can kind of diminish his minutes a little bit, put him in a different role if you're Edmonton. I did like the question you asked of Mark Spector. Like, do they bring him in for pedigree? Because I've made this comment before, and I'll say it again. Like, you look at Ryan Nugent-Hopkins' long-term deal, 8 years. It doesn't matter after 4 or 5 years. You know why? Because after 4 years, Connor McDavid can either sign an extension or he can't. Leon Draisaitl is off your books at that year. He becomes a free agent. So it's, to me, they have to talk about this team in the here and now, and what can you do in the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years, or else it doesn't matter because Connor McDavid's out of Edmonton at that point.
So what, Karen, I mean, you're the resident Edmonton Oilers fan here on this show, right? Like, what's your reaction as a fan? Take off the analyst hat, put on the fan hat. What is your reaction to what looks to be a reality now that Duncan Keith is going to be playing for the Oilers next year?
Well, if all reports are true, and this is the deal that Holland wanted to give Stan Bowman, then I'm okay with that, because I think Ken Holland knew what he wanted to pay for a 38-year-old Duncan Keith with 2 years left on his deal, and understood that, yes, I think if I want him on my roster and playing for me, he still has value left, obviously, if Ken Holland still sees that with a 38-year-old player. But you can't overpay for this player at this point. You can't give away these prospects just because this is what Chicago wants in return. I'm okay with it. I would have preferred to have, say, an Oscar Klefbom back in the lineup.
Yep.
I think his upside is a lot better than a Duncan Keith. Maybe he comes back at some point in the season. That changes all of that dynamics there. But I'm okay with it right now. I do want to see what the return is when this finally gets done. I do, but it's a guy who's won. It's a guy who has, you know, Norris days, Conn Smythe days are very much behind him, but a guy I still do think in the right role can be productive on the blue line.
Yeah, it's just, for me, it's just all about did Edmonton take advantage of all the leverage they had here? Because they had a ton of leverage, right? And if they did get a great discount on cap hit, on the assets they're sending to Chicago, then I think it can really help them. It sounds like that's probably the case, right? That Chicago had to come back to the table and basically say, okay, you got us. What can we do to make this work? Frank Saravelli is now reporting, pending a trade call, it sounds like Hawks Duncan Keith will indeed be heading to the Oilers in exchange for Caleb Jones and a mid-round pick, either third or fourth round. Final details still being ironed out. So is that an acceptable price for you, Karen, to pay for Duncan Keith?
I think so. It's a younger prospect, but you're not giving away a Evan Bouchard, which hopefully projects to be a good NHL player one day. Also, the Swedish guy who Mark Spector did talk about as well. He came over, started camp,
Broberg.
played the season in Sweden. He did come over at the end of the year, so I think the expectation is he'll be playing in North America next year. I do wonder what is the trickle-down effect of this, Jamie, because the next quoted tweet from Adam Bingham with The Athletic says, Seth to Chicago is confirmed. Of course, Seth Jones being the brother of Caleb Jones, the highly touted, I can't say free agent because he still has 1 year left on his deal, but he has told Columbus that he is not going to re-sign, at least with an extension this offseason. He wants to test free agency. Does this lead you to believe that even if it wasn't Caleb Jones, like, I mean, Chicago seems to me like a destination, an American-born kid, you know, going to Chicago, an original six, you're part of the rebuild there. You could be part of the future rebuild. Does Seth Jones end up, in your opinion, as a Chicago Blackhawk?
I mean, that's always seemed like the most likely destination, right? You know, adding Caleb Jones, I don't know how much it moves the needle. Maybe a little bit for me. We should point out the Adam Vingan tweet. He covers the Predators for The Athletic. He is tweeting in jest, right?
Yes,
that Seth
in
Jones
jest.
To Chicago has been confirmed. We do not have confirmation of that deal just yet. But I think even if they didn't go get Caleb Jones, that Chicago would still be the front runner for Seth Jones's services this offseason, right? And I mean, that's one of the big reasons that they felt this sense of urgency to get Keith off the books, right? Is to create the room to go out and acquire Seth Jones. So, you know, maybe if you want to extrapolate a little bit here, you say, okay, the fact that they were willing to lower their price for Duncan Keith, maybe they have some traction with Columbus and a Seth Jones deal is in the works, or could be a little closer than we thought it might be. So, look, we started off the show, or we started off the second hour of the show, I should say, by saying this is going to be an extremely busy few weeks in the NHL, and we're starting to see that already with this one move, right? There's ripple effects that could affect a whole bunch of teams around the league.
Yeah, modified no trade clause, 10-team list he cannot be traded to, so it appears that Chicago would be, I mean, it's them, they heard Philly, like, there's been a lot of teams would want the services of a Seth Jones, and I mean, so Duncan Keith on his way out, Brent Seabrook's done, Jonathan Toews, he looks healthy, he says. I mean, does he play another game in the NHL or for the Chicago Blackhawks? We don't know. We'll have to see how the season goes. But then there's Patrick Kane. And I wanted to get into Patrick Kane for a second here because he's the kind of last remaining core, or is the last remaining core on the Chicago Blackhawks team. But actually, he's also the best player in the NHL. Did you hear this, Jamie?
I heard something about this, yes, over the weekend. Okay. I don't know.
Of all the things that were going on this weekend, you had the Wimbledon men's final, which had Novak Djokovic winning his 20th Grand Slam. You had the England-Italy Euro final. There was game 3 of the NBA finals, which we haven't even talked about that. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. There was tons of stuff going on. And then there was the ESPYs that were held on Saturday night. And I don't know about you. I used to watch the ESPYs. I thought it was fun. I thought it was like a good show. It's always fun to see the Courage to Come Back award winner, you know, Stuart Scott giving his emotional speech when he knew he was dying of cancer. And it was just one of the more phenomenal moments that I've ever seen on television. But it's also a fan voted award. So Patrick Kane was named the most exciting player and the best player in the NHL. It strikes me as a little odd, and this strikes me as the fact that, yes, it's only Americans voting on this, and I think it also points to the fact that no one saw Connor McDavid play this season in the U.S.
And it's name recognition, right? He's an high-profile American player who's been on TV a lot south of the border, right, with all the deep playoff runs that he was on with the Chicago Blackhawks over the last decade. So it's not surprising. I don't know, man. It's, for me, it's like it's the ESPYs. Who really cares? You know what I mean? This is not an MVP award. This is not a major international sporting award or anything like that. This is a totally contrived, made-for-television event. I get it. I get why. And I know fans look at this and say, well, if ESPN is going to be covering hockey now, like, is this the standard we're going to expect? Yeah. Who cares? It's the ESPYs. Who cares?
Well, and it should be pointed out, it's not voted on by NHL media that are going to ESPN. This is a fan-voted award. Chicago, Patrick Kane, he's the biggest name. I mean, I guess you say Austin Matthews, but again, he plays in the North Division in Canada. How much did the Americans see him this past year? Patrick Kane, the biggest name, probably the best American-born player so far to ever play in the NHL. I think that's probably a fair assessment. So I do understand it, but it was like, the guy was the unanimous vote for the Hart Trophy. Like, not one person didn't have him as number one on his ballot for Connor McDavid, and the fans down south of the border just didn't seem to watch him this season. We've got some other breaking news coming in of the baseball variety, Jamie, and the fact that Shohei Ohtani, not only is he going to be in the All-Star Home Run Derby tonight, not only is he going to bat in the All-Star game, he's going to be the starting pitcher for the American League. This kid's incredible.
It's pretty wild. Imagine, you know, a few years ago before we knew about Shohei Ohtani, before he had burst on the scene with the Angels, just trying to tell somebody that, yeah, a baseball player is going to hit in the home run derby, probably be the favorite to win the event. And I know there's a lot of good home run hitters in the event, but given what he's doing on a regular basis in games, I think you have to consider Shohei Ohtani the favorite tonight. Somebody's going to be the favorite at the home run derby. Oh, and then by the way, they're also going to be the starting pitcher in the All-Star game the next day. It seems like something out of a movie, right? Out of a Hollywood screenplay, something you would never, ever imagine actually happening, actually coming to fruition. I can't believe it. I'm excited. And he's going to bat leadoff too. So, like, this is going – Major League Baseball collectively, and I think this is completely smart on their part, doing everything they can – to put Shohei Ohtani in the spotlight over the next couple of days.
As he should. I mean, he's their brightest star right now. And you and I have discussed it. Scott's discussed it. We have every single expert on it. He's a unicorn. Like, there's nobody else that ever has been like him. And people can point to Babe Ruth. But no, Babe Ruth was not doing what Shohei Ohtani is doing. It's just, it's spectacular to watch. And for me, when I think about players and athletes right now that I can watch, and there's, you know, a variety of things. Like, if you go to social media because I want to see the highlights of his at-bat, like, when you go and you see a home run that Shohei Ohtani has hit, your entire Twitter feed, if you follow baseball guys, is all it's either videos of it or just talking about how incredible he is. And then you'll add on the fact that he's an incredible pitcher, he's got incredible starting numbers, and the list goes on and on. Like, he's must-see TV. Like, at least for me, when he's at bat and I can watch him, he's must-see TV. I would love to see him in person. Like, that's one of the things that makes me go, oh, I wish the borders were open so we can drive down to Seattle to see the Angels play.
It's, you know, I mentioned this when we had Dan Shulman on the show earlier. Like, this is one of those crossover stories that even people who aren't big baseball fans, who aren't even big sports fans, want to talk to you about, right? Because they've heard, like, this guy's pitching and hitting. And, you know, I was trying to explain it to somebody on the weekend, and I was saying, if there was a player who is a pitcher and a hitter and they were just average at both, that would be an incredible story. Like, that would be an incredible accomplishment, right? To just be a number three pitcher and a pretty decent hitter at the same time, that would be a remarkable accomplishment. He's an all-star at both. He's leading the league in home runs by a significant margin. He's on pace for 60 home runs, and he's an absolutely filthy starting pitcher. It's not just that he's doing both. He's doing both at an incredibly high level. And you're right. He is right now dominating the news of this baseball season. He is the story of Major League Baseball this year. We have a texter text in 650, 650, or 960, 960 are the numbers. Says Shohei is a real life MLB The Show character. That sums it up. He's a video game character right now. This was only previously possible in video games or movies, but he's doing it in real life.
Okay, so you got Shohei Ohtani, who's going to hit the crap out of the ball today, hopefully, at the Home Run Derby. He's going to start the All-Star game. He's going to bat leadoff. He is just, you have to watch him every time he's on the field. You got Novak Djokovic, who's going to go down as the greatest tennis player of all time, just needs one more major. He hits number 20 on the weekend. You got Conor McGregor on the weekend. Like, I know we don't talk a lot of UFC on this program, but I rented it. I watched it. It was a very disappointing fight because of the fact that he broke his ankle at the end of that first round. I don't know what it is, Jamie, but lately they've got those massive, disgusting injuries. You've got the Weidman broken tibia, fibula out of his... It was disgusting. Now you've got this with Conor McGregor, who tweeted out yesterday that he underwent surgery. He's okay. But it leads you to, okay, like, it's Conor McDavid. Shohei Ohtani is must-see right now. Novak Djokovic, if you're a big tennis fan and sports fan, you're probably going to watch him in these big final events. It's like something history in the making. Like, is Conor McGregor still that must-see draw for UFC? Or is it too much where it's just, he's too about the show and the fighting's not there anymore? Like, does he still have that must-see gravitas for you?
McGregor's such an interesting case for this, right? And listeners, text in, you know, who are the must-see athletes out there across sports for you right now? 650, 650, or 960, 960. McGregor's so fascinating because I think a lot of hardcore UFC fans, and I don't include myself in that category, but a lot of hardcore MMA UFC fans would say, no, he's not must-watch. He's washed up. Look at his resume. Look at his record over the last number of years. It is not impressive at all. He is not that exciting for me. But he still makes every event feel like a big deal. Mm-hmm. He still draws eyeballs. He still draws viewers. And I think the mystique of Conor McGregor, even though the fight was a total letdown because of the injury, it was really captured by, you know, he's lying in the ring, sitting in the ring with a broken leg, cutting this absurd, ridiculous promo about how he was going to completely dominate Poirier if that fight had continued, even though that's not what was happening at all in the fight. Like, it's a ridiculous idea. It doesn't make any sense, but he's able to sell it, and he just has that ability to always be promoting himself, always be selling, and it works still. It still works. I don't find it that entertaining. I would not put him in my must-see category at all, but for enough people out there, he still has that ability to just create hype for anything he's doing.
So first of all, Dustin Poirier really had no reason to take this fight, other than it was 3.0, the payday that Conor McGregor brings with it. But he's the number one contender for the lightweight. And it really, this fight meant nothing other than to get out there and show him that he can beat Conor McGregor. You look at the fact there was no title fight on this card, Jamie. Just a bunch of fights. They were good fights, and there was a couple of, you know, the undercard was pretty good with Gilbert Burns and the guy he's fighting. His name escapes me right now, but still, there is no title fight, and look at who all shows up. Like, ringside, Machine Gun Kelly and Megan Fox were right there, smack dab in the middle of every shot that I had. There was one of the Kardashians, I forget her name, with Travis Barker, a little too much PDA on television. But it's just, it brings out, he still brings out all the stars, and there's not even, like, a title on the line. Like, Conor McGregor is must-see TV for a lot of people because they just love being part of the show and being there and being seen at a Conor McGregor event.
And this unsigned text along those same lines comes into the Vancouver inbox, 650-650, says, McGregor will always be a huge draw. It's an event. The hardcore MMA fans are a spiteful yep. bunch. They hate almost every athlete. Yeah, I understand that. There's always this rush to say, but, oh, everyone thinks this guy is so great, but he's actually a fraud, yada, yada, yada. I get that. But for McGregor, I mean, it's people aren't nitpicking when they're pointing to his flaws as a fighter, as a competitor right now, right? Like, he has not been able to back up the talk and the hype for quite some time now. Not on a consistent basis, but what you're saying is correct. What the texter is saying is correct. Despite those deficiencies as a competitor in UFC, he's still able to make, at least for now, we'll see after he rehabs and, you know, after he gets back in the ring, but he's still able for now to make every event feel like a big deal, feel like a prize fight that people want to be at.
Someone texts in, thank you for the 650, 650, 960, 960, Wonderboy Thompson. Yes, that was the guy who took on Gilbert Burns. Burns beat him. It was fun to see. Here, quickly though, I wanted to say this, Jamie, because we're talking about athletes like must-see TV, and I saw this on social media on the weekend, and I know for our listeners, this is kind of not their cup of tea, and it might be not your cup of tea either, but I threw in Simone Biles. And if you saw going around on Twitter on the weekend, it was a camera view of one of her...
Yep.
Floor routines. And it shows the angle of her doing one of her crazy flips, whatever they were, in the air. And the angle that showed it just showed her continue rising and rising and rising and rising in the air before she finished her final flip and came down. But the amount that she rises and the power that she has packed into this little body, she has changed gymnastics and the way that we look at gymnasts. And the incredible power that she can do, like the fact that she can step out of bounds in a routine, can fall off the balance beam. That happened in the U.S. Olympic trials, but she still finishes first because her level of difficulty is so much higher than everybody else in the gymnastics field that it doesn't matter if she makes a mistake because she is just so much at a different level than everyone else. So I would suggest, I don't know if our listeners want to, but go on Twitter, look at this, look up the clip, but also when the Olympics start in a couple of weeks from now, like, I do think she is a must-watch, generational-defining athlete.
I think that's a great, great nomination, Karen, because, you know, one of the hallmarks of a must-see athlete is that they can draw in people who normally don't really care about the sport, right? And, mm-hmm. I mean, Simone Biles' floor routine, that's probably the number one appointment television viewing at the Olympics this year, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is going to be the event that you simply, if you had to choose one event to watch at the Summer Olympics, that's the event you're going to choose because she is so remarkable. So, yeah, Simone Biles, definitely in the must-see category for me. We're getting a lot of great submissions. I think we'll get mm-hmm. back into this a little later yes. in the show. But that's one I hadn't thought of, and it absolutely hits the mark for me.
It just came to me when I saw her on Twitter, and I was just like, holy cow. Like that, she's a little pint-sized thing, and she's
you can't
just
believe
incredible.
It. You can't believe what she's doing. Yeah,
it's awesome. Okay, we're going to switch the pace. We're going to talk a little more footy after the break. James Sharman, analyst with the Footy Prime podcast. We're going to ask him. He tweeted out yesterday, just gutted. We'll ask him if he's over or if he can get over the loss of England to Italy near a final. That's coming up next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
I've teased it, Jamie. I've teased it. I think it's now finally time to talk about it. You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon. Scott Rintoul will be back tomorrow. Jamie Dodd filling his chair today. Thanks, as always, for Jamie for doing this. Jamie, Scott's a bigger person than I am. Probably in the fact that I would have rubbed it in and he didn't. We had the bet going in for those listeners that were maybe missed the Friday show. We were trying to think about what we could do for the bet. And it's like singing on air. Well, I'm like, do I want that saved for the rest of time and can be dropped on different shows. Like, so I'm a terrible singer. I am. Someone one time heard me singing in the background and said I have a voice of an angel. That is untrue. It is untrue. I'm tone deaf. It's just ridiculous. So I didn't want to do that. And then Scott said, well, you know, like maybe we hold up a sign. Like if I was to go to Commercial Drive in Vancouver, which is where Little Italy is, and hold up a go. Well, I guess I'd have to do go in Italy sign in Little Britain, wherever that is. But, you know, vice versa, hold up a sign and honk for Italy or honk for England. I'm thinking that's okay. Yeah. You know, an hour of public humiliation. And then someone texted in the beer mile. And I don't think I understood what I was getting into when I made this bet. I honestly don't. Like, so for those that don't know, you run a mile, and every quarter of a mile, so if you're doing a track, basically every lap around the track, you stop and you chug a beer. And we made the bet that it was going to be a light beer, because if England had won, I could have given Scott like a Newcastle or something heavy, and that's just not fair. So I think probably we'll decide on Peroni. I did get some listeners giving me some other beers, but at least I've drank Peroni before, so I actually know what it kind of tastes like. I'm a little worried, though. Like,
I mean, I think it's fair to be worried.
I don't run a lot. I did try to start. I run a couple half marathons, but my running days are behind me. I tried to start running when the pandemic started, but then I invested in a Peloton, and I have not been out running again since. Like, I like my anaerobic, 45-minute, half-an-hour workouts on the bike. That's great. I understand that a mile's not that long, but I'm not quite sure where my running skills are at right now and my aerobic endurance is. And then I'm also not quite sure where they are after 2-3 chugs of beer.
Yeah, that's the tough part.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll just say I'm very, very glad that I was not personally involved in this bet in any way, because I would not want to be in your shoes. I would be like, people would have to be on standby with the defibrillators if I was the one doing this. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it goes. Scott is, I think we're going to have to wait until next week to do it. So hopefully I can get some training practices in, maybe run one lap and chug a beer and then go home and see if that works. We're joined now with James Sharman. He's been with us through all of Euro. We appreciate his joining us today. Analyst with the Footy Prime podcast. James, I got to ask you, you did tweet out, just gutted yesterday after the match, followed with a very nice text about or tweet about Italy. But how are you feeling today? How are your emotions after yesterday's loss by England?
Well, I'll tell you, Karen, if I lost a bet and had to do a beer mile, I mean, is that ready for losing? I mean, that sounds like a great win to me. I mean, that sounds amazing.
I'll let you know how if it stays down, for one, and how it goes by the end of that fourth beer. But it should be interesting. James, let's start with the beginning of the match. And as the match went on, obviously all of our listeners know, in Italy won in penalty kicks, but England probably, I don't know if they got off this start they wanted to, because it almost felt like they scored too early with the Shaw goal in the second minute. Your opinion of the early goal and then kind of how the match went from there?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, listen, every team in the world would love to score inside 2 minutes, right? I mean, it's a great way to start a game, but there is that old sports adage that you can score too early, and especially if you then decide to bunker down and defend, that's a long time to defend against a good team like Italy. And I thought that England really got very conservative and began to defend very deeply after about the 25-minute mark, and partly that's because Italy played so well, I know that, but I wish they were a bit more aggressive, because to start that game, they were just dominating out wide in the midfield, and, you know, Italy looked very vulnerable. So it was a bit of a surprise and disappointing to see England not really take advantage of that. But I think we just have to tip our hat to Italy, really, who made it very hard for England, who were, you know, really in uncharted territory.
Yeah, I agree about, you know, you have to give a lot of credit to Italy for the way they played yesterday and throughout the whole tournament, James. But, you know, the English manager, Gareth Southgate, he took a lot of criticism for a lot of his different decisions throughout the tournament. But, I mean, they worked. They got England to the final. When you're just looking at the way he planned things yesterday and the way he set his lineup yesterday, what, if anything, is it fair to criticize about how Southgate approached yesterday's match?
Yeah, I mean, there is some for sure, but overall, I mean, like you mentioned there, you know, he proved all the cynics wrong. Everything he touched turned to gold until the final, it seemed. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Gareth Southgate, but yesterday, perhaps it was just that, you know, when they went ahead, then naturally he's quite a pragmatic manager. He was a defender as a player, and maybe that took over. he didn't really feel comfortable freeing his attacking players throughout this tournament, and maybe he brought his subs on too late. But I think the biggest, you know, criticism for him from yesterday was just that bringing on Marcus Rashford and Jadon Sancho, specifically for penalties with about 2 minutes left. So they didn't get warmed up and, you know, went into the game at all, and then they both missed their penalties, and then allowing a 19-year-old in Bakayo Saka to step up for that all-important fifth kick. For someone that's been in that position himself back in Euro 1996, I was surprised he didn't go with someone with a bit more experience in the shootouts. Now, you know, you understand that Saka and Rashford and Sancho were the in-form spot kick takers during practice all week. They wanted the ball, they volunteered, and, you know, it's incredible courage for them, especially as young guys. But I think maybe for that fifth penalty, they could have gone with someone more experienced. But listen, you know, it's penalties. In the end, someone's going to miss, right? And it turned out it was the 19-year-old kid. But I think you could maybe criticize him for that somewhat. But overall, you know, if people are looking at Gareth Southgate and are being critical now, then I don't think they watched the whole tournament, because overall, what he touched really turned to gold.
And again, you have to give Italy, you can't just pin it all on England or their manager. You have to give Italy a ton of credit as well. You know, just on the topic of penalties, I remember going into the last World Cup, there was so much discussion about England's performance historically in penalties, and then they get the win in the knockout stage over Colombia, and there was this hope that, okay, we're entering a new era where England can go into these penalty situations with confidence. Do you feel now, with the way it unfolded yesterday, that England's almost back to square one, and the next time they're in this situation, it's going to be just as stressful and just as pressure-packed as it's ever been for them?
Yeah, it's a really good point, because, I mean, I remember 3 years ago at the World Cup and that Colombia win, it was a big moment for English football, because they showed that they can finally get it done when they had to from the spot kicks. And now, you know, fast forward 3 years, and again on the biggest stage in 55 years, they lose in a shootout. And there's no doubt now that whenever it happens next, be it in the last 16 at a World Cup or in a World Cup final, whenever it is, it's going to happen. And we're all going to remember what happened at Wembley in 2021. So it's up to these players now to prove us wrong and to show us that they're winners and that they can actually take this and don't be tortured like the last groups of players who played for England who lost over and over again. You know, win one again and get over that hump. So it'd be really interesting. You know, this group of players, we keep being told they're different. We keep being told that they're young and they're confident, that they're a little bit brash, but they're not arrogant. It'd be fascinating to see how they deal with this loss. They're very young, and we shouldn't forget that. This team is, I think, the second youngest team at Euro. These kids who, you know, missed the penalties are 19, 22, 23. They got a long career ahead of them. So it's going to be really interesting watching this team evolve and what happens next time they face that kind of pressure. Have they learned from it, or will they crumble?
We're speaking with James Sharman, analyst with the Footy Prime podcast. James, I wanted to ask about tactics when it does come to penalty kicks, because it's got to be difficult for a manager. One, you've got guys in training that tend to do well. You've got, do you go with guys like Harry Kane, Harry Maguire, who stepped up? They're veterans. They've, you know, the pressure of being in these moments before, they've been there, done that, and they looked very confident in their two kicks. But you also have the idea of a 19-year-old kicking in the fifth spot, but you can't save like a Harry Kane for the fifth spot, because you might actually not even get there. Like, how difficult it is in figuring out the best mix, shall we say, for a kick, for a penalty kicks?
Yeah, you're kind of damned if you do, right, and damned if you don't. It seems that from a stats standpoint, you want to be the first kicker, because the stats suggest that if you're the first kicker, your team's likely going to win, or there's more chance of winning for some reason. But I've always believed in, you know, just score the goals as soon as you can. So get your best guys up there first. Get Harry Kane up there. Harry Maguire's got history as well. He knows how to do it. Get it done. I'm surprised that he took off Jordan Henderson, who was subbed on, of course, and then subbed off, because, you know, I know he missed a kick in, I believe, the last exhibition game before Euro. But that being said, I've seen him score a lot of penalties from the spot for Liverpool. And he's got experience. He's a calm head out there. But he took him off, you know, and brought on Rashford and Sancho. So is there a tactic behind it? You know, I think it, what Gareth Southgate said post-match was interesting, in that, you know, we said we practiced a lot. We always practiced our kicks, and these guys were my best takers. But, of course, you can't duplicate the pressure in practice, right? You can hit the top corner and pick out the corners during a practice match, but when you got 70,000 fans in the stadium and, you know, close to a billion sets of eyes worldwide watching this different monster entirely. So, you know, listen, I really believe that penalties are a skill and that it's not luck, it's not a lottery. I think, you know, mental strength is definitely a skill. So prepare for it as much as you can. But in the end, I think if a guy says to you in that huddle before the kicks, listen, Gaffer, I want the ball, give me the ball, I'm confident, I think you kind of have to give him the ball. And that seems to be what happened.
When Roberto Mancini took over this team, he told this squad, and he told, said, like, look, we can win the Euros. And it took them some convincing. They talked about it on the broadcast, but they bought in, and obviously they got to the pinnacle. Can the job that Roberto Mancini has done, they've won 33 matches in a row, I believe, which is tied with, or unbeaten in 33 matches in a row, which is tied with Spain for the record. Like, can you just put into words the job that he has done with this country's side?
It's incredible. Not just that they've won all these games and they've now won a championship, but just how they've redefined Italian football. I mean, missing out on the World Cup, as you can imagine, I mean, even if you're not a soccer fan, you know that Italians love their soccer. And that was beyond a calamity. That broke a nation's heart. And, you know, the World Cup, frankly, wasn't quite the same without Italy in it. So to rebuild that team and that squad with you know, there's some real youth coming through there, but really with the same players, you know, the Immobiles, Insignias, would have been at the World Cup, but they missed out. And now they're into their prime as opposed to being, you know, really young kids. And to rebuild around these guys, we're still having that foundation of Bonucci and Chiellini. It was incredible. And the tactics, how they now are an attacking team, a team that loves to have the ball. You know, these days of the old defensive Italy, as much as they're a great defensive team still, they're so much more than just that. So I think what he's done for Italian football, it's hard to root against them. You watch them, they play with smiles on their faces. You see in the pre-tournament get-togethers when they named the squad, it was great. It was like Euro trash at its very, very best. They really enjoyed being there. And, you know, Chiellini laughing and Justin during matches. It's just a different Italy, a different feel. And it's all because of Roberto Mancini, who had his own heart broken on numerous occasions as a player. He's one of the greatest players in the world, but he didn't have a big World Cup or a big Euro because he kept falling out with managers. He knew what it means to miss out on tournaments, so he really made it a point to make everyone, you know, appreciate where they are, but also to enjoy it, to feel free and loose during that tournament. So I think Mancini has done just incredible work, and he's got a great team behind him, and obviously, you know, the World Cup's, what, a year and 5 months away, and who's to say they shouldn't be the favourites for that now?
You know, you mentioned the different feel of this Italy side, right? That they're much more attacking, much more comfortable going forward. That's true, but I got to say, yesterday watching the match in particular, I was so impressed with Bonucci and Chiellini at the back, right? The veteran partnership at center back, they were so solid. Bonucci ends up getting the goal that brings them level against England. What did that partnership between those two veteran defenders mean for Italy throughout this tournament?
Well, in everything. You look at the Italian team over generations, they've always had great centre-backs, you know, and full-backs. Some of the biggest names to play for Italy have been defenders. And that's just now continued. Back in 06 when they won the World Cup, it was Cannavaro. He was the man, the best player of the tournament, a centre-back. And then these guys are kind of the evolution of that defence. They're players that play together week in and week out for Juventus. They're old, and we heard they were immobile. And, you know, you could get in behind them, but they're so wily. You know, technically they're very, very good, but they're so wily. And we saw some of the professional fouls yesterday. There's one in particular late in the game,
yep,
where Chiellini grabbed Saka's his collar and tucked him back. It looked brutal, right? But just a clever foul. It was definitely a yellow card, probably somewhere in between that yellow and red, but it wasn't a full red. So I think the referee called it right. But just the things that they will do to win a game, you know, they will bleed for their country. They will do some terrible things to win for their country, but they're beloved because of it. So, you know, they're best friends off the field as well. I'm trying to think of a sporting combo like them right now. I don't think there is one. I think Bonucci and Chiellini, it is the Bonucci and Chiellini show, isn't it, really? And they're legends now.
Yeah, especially in penalty of Chiellini, he was putting on a show, and you just got the sense that how much that must relax your whole team, right? To have your veteran leader, you know, embracing the moment like he did. It was just incredible to see. As you say, James, all of a sudden, you know, we're just a year and a little bit away from another World Cup. Could this be the start of a run on top internationally for Italy?
Yeah, I think it could well be. We'll see. I mean, Patrick Kalini and Bonucci here, I mean, they're not kids, right? They're old. Bonucci is, I think, 34, 35, and Kalini's older than that, 36 or 37. I think they've still got another good year in them, right? So they might well be there now. Now, who's beyond? They've got some very good young defenders in the squad there, but, you know, obviously the identity is those two players right now. I think it could be a run. I think you're going to see England and Italy in big matches for a long time because of the youth, because of the ages of their squads and the way they play the game. So I think that bodes really, really well. But if you're an Azzurri fan right now, obviously you're still just celebrating yesterday, but I think there's a good chance you'll be celebrating, you know, in Qatar in 2022. You know, if not a championship, a very deep run, because they're kind of evolving in it's this new style of football that they're playing now. And it's just, you know, it's so modern. We had Catenaccio with Italy years ago. Then total football came around. And now you've got this new kind of breed that Italy and Spain as well are playing. It's fun to watch. So, yeah, you know, Italy are going nowhere. They're going to be around for a while. And, you know, there might be some little changes here and there to the squad. But overall, they're going to be probably perhaps the team to beat.
James, we got to talk about this quickly, and it just sucks in the aftermath. It was a crazy day leading up to in London, and we saw the fans trying to storm Wembley, those that didn't have tickets, and then you saw all the stuff going around in the city, and then the unfortunate racial comments that were hurled at Rashford and Sancho and Saka after they missed their penalty shots. And I tried to not go down that rabbit hole on Twitter, but I did, and I'm sad that I did because it was disgusting. But, I mean, it's sad because it just seems to be an ongoing, continuing thing. And I didn't even think of it as the first thing as I thought of when these three kids missed the kick. I thought to myself, okay, there's two 19-year-olds, and I'm thinking, is this going to be like a Gareth Southgate? Is this going to weigh on them for the rest of their football careers? And then you see the racial aspect of it. It's like, I just don't know where this goes, and I just don't know if it will get better.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, it's so depressing. At the same time, it's so predictable too, isn't it? You know, mm-hmm. You look what's happened the last, you know, well, forever, but in particular the last couple of years on social media and the hate that these players receive on a regular basis and how the social media companies just seem to refuse to take it seriously. I don't know what the solution is. You know, unfortunately, there are some sick people out there who don't understand and don't see that what they're saying can be so damaging and is so wrong. It even goes beyond social media. This current, you know, incident issue was there's neo-Nazi groups in North America and UK who are using this as their fuel, their weaponry to get their point across. I mean, my God, you know, I don't know where these people come from, what created these people, but to focus on these three kids after what they've been through, you know, I don't know what to say. It's sickening.
Yeah.
It's sad, but like you said, you know, I don't know what the solution is unless the social media companies take real action. But obviously, it goes beyond that, right? It's just within society, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we won't leave you on that note. I wanted to ask you one more final question because Messi finally got that international trophy. Argentina won the Copa America. They beat Brazil on the weekend. I know you said before, and you know, in your mind, it's not something he needed, but in some people's mind, it was what he needed, being that final conversation with Cristiano Ronaldo. But your thoughts on seeing that and seeing how happy Messi was after the victory?
Yeah, it's just great to see, isn't it? And it's amazing that the one game that he didn't dominate was the game that actually gave him that trophy finally. And maybe the naysayers now will just say, okay, he's got his big championship. Okay, it's not a World Cup, but it's a Copa. It's pretty important. And I think it might change the narrative within Argentina and how he's seen. Obviously, Maradona is always going to be number one, but there's always been a bit of suspicion about Messi. Is he for real, you know, in Argentina? And now he's won it for his country. And the joy he showed throughout this tournament, I think it's just brilliant. And like you said, for me, he can't accomplish anything more, you know. But, you know, now he's won that. Hopefully the Ronaldo-Messi debate will rage on, I'm sure. But at least now the Ronaldo fan base can't say, well, you know, what's he done for his country? Because now he's done more than Ronaldo. You know, he's won a championship and he's got to a World Cup final. So, hey, let's enjoy them both.
Yes. But, yes, let's do that.
Gives him a little bit extra, maybe.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, James. Hey, we appreciate you always coming on with us during this entire tournament. We appreciate your insight. And I know we have a busy soccer calendar coming up here in the fall. We've got the World Cup qualifiers for Canada starting back up in September. So hopefully we can check in with you again. But again, just thank you so much for your time during these Euros.
No, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it. And enjoy the beer run, okay? It's not a bad thing. It'll be a lot of fun. Just embrace it.
Okay, I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to channel my James Sharman as I run around a track chugging beers. I'll do that, James. Thanks again.
All right, bye.
Have a good one. That was James Sharman, of course, him and Craig Forrest, parts of Footy Prime Podcast. They were with us throughout the entire Euros. We always enjoy their insight. And James sounds pretty... He sounds pretty pragmatic in terms of he's talking about England and the match and understanding. I mean, it's obvious where his loyalties.
Yeah, you know who he's rooting for, obviously. But sorry. He's able to keep it in perspective.
I thought Greg just put some, you know, when you work from home and you have your computer up and all of a sudden a pop-up ad plays?
Yes.
I totally thought that Greg just went to break, so I stopped talking. I'm thinking, why is there some music playing in the background? So thank you, Jamie, for jumping in there. It was just technical on my side. Yes, anyways, James is always great with his analysis, and it's just him and Craig. It's just great, and hopefully, you know, we've got some big matches coming up here in September. I know we've got the Gold Cup right now. No Alphonso Davies with that ankle, and Jonathan David not playing. He's back in France preparing for their season, but he'll be back September, and we've got, what, 14 matches to, like, the push, I think it is? Like, it's going to be in a crazy couple of months.
Well, yeah, I'm really looking forward. It is remarkable because, you know, this Euro was pushed back by a year that we're basically already in the run-up to the next World Cup. And then, as you say, that doesn't just involve the big countries in South America and Europe, right? Canada has some incredibly important matches that are going to be starting in the fall. I know I'm really looking forward to those.
Absolutely. Okay, we got some more information coming in on this Edmonton Duncan Keith trade. Yes, Duncan Keith is heading to Edmonton for some return and a little curiosity about what was not in this deal. We'll talk about that next. You are listening to Rintoul and Zimmer with Jamie Dodd filling in on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Yes, you're listening to Rintoul and Sermon, one hour, final hour to go in the show. And Jamie Dodd sitting in for Scott Rintoul. He will be back tomorrow after his victorious. He took like a buffer day because he's so happy that Italy won. That's basically what Scott did, Jamie. He took a buffer day.
Yeah, he's like, Italy he's in won. No shape to come in today.
He was partying at a kid's birthday party somewhere, and he's just, I need that extra day. So he will be back tomorrow, Jamie Dodd, filling in as always for Scott Rintoul. Now, Jamie, I teased it on the other side. And we had talked to Mark Spector earlier in the show. And we're actually going to play a clip of Mark Spector. But Duncan Keith to the Edmonton Oilers is done. Caleb Jones is going the other way. And a third round pick. So you would ask me, what do I think of this deal? And I said, okay, well, like, let's just hear if there's any salary tension. Because at this point, it was kind of like, okay, this is rumored what this is going to happen. We had to get into James Sharman, talk about England losing to Italy, all that kind of stuff. And then we find out, as, you know, more things keep filtering out, that there's no salary retained in the Keith trade to the Oilers deal. So here's the thing. Let's, like, set this up. Duncan Keith is 38 years old. His best playing days are behind him. But, sorry, he's 37. He'll be 38 when he's born on July 16th, so his birthday's coming up. He'll be 38 when the season starts. He's got $5.538 left on his salary, cap hit, for the next 2 years. He controlled a lot of this, but it appeared to the fact that Chicago only had one real trade partner with him. The big thing that I think with this that... I still don't understand it. I still don't get why there was no salary retained by the Chicago Blackhawks, especially if you're handing in a sweetener in a third-round pick. But here's the real money. $3.6 million over the next two seasons. So of the 11-some-odd million that's going to be on the cap hit, only real money given to Duncan Keith is that $3.6 million. And if I'm looking at this, Jamie, and Mark Spector tweeted it out on Twitter, there could be something to the fact that there was no revenue last year for the Edmonton Oilers, not to mention any of the Canadian teams up until Montreal in the playoffs. And is Darryl Cates and this team looking at it going, okay, yeah, the cap hit is a little bit, but we don't have to pay this guy hardly any real cash.
And I understand that, you know, because of COVID, the flat cap, no fans in stands, that a lot of teams are feeling a financial pinch. I understand that. It's still, I mean, it's very thin comfort if you're a fan of the Edmonton Oilers, I would think, right? Like, oh, yeah, okay, we had to give up meaningful assets to get Duncan Keith, and we didn't get any salary retained by Chicago. Hey, but at least it's going to help the owner save a little money. I mean, the Edmonton Oilers, they have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl on their team right now. Like, the goal shouldn't be to save money. The goal shouldn't be to pocket a few extra million dollars. The goal should be to put a winning team around those two players. And man, when I saw the deal, the details of the deal, when it was just getting reported, I basically assumed that there would be salary retained by Chicago. Yeah. That's the only way it would make sense to not only go out and acquire the player, and we can, you know, have the debate about whether or not he can still be effective on the ice. I'm probably a little more optimistic about that than a lot of people, that if you put him in the right spot, he can still do certain things well for you. But it's still, given the position that Chicago was in, how do you not get them to retain some of his salary here?
And this text coming in, am I missing something? Edmonton gives up a young defenseman and a third-round pick for a 37-year-old Duncan Keith with a $5.5 million cap hit for 2 years. Chicago should have given up a draft pick to take him off the books. Bad trade for the Oilers. And the point is, that comes in from Dave. And text them in, 650-650-960-960. The point being is, you would have thought there would have been some salary retention when you see that third-round pick attached to it. And so I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, well, Darryl Cates, you know, I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he has a lot of money, right?
He has a lot of money. I
know the pandemic, everyone took a hit. I completely understand that, but he still has a lot of money. So really, is the savings of what, $8 million between the cap hit versus the actual money paid out, is that much going to really affect your bottom line? Maybe it is. Like, I don't know how Rexall's been doing, and I don't know how all his other businesses have been doing, but to me, it does look like a little bit of Oilers. Ken Holland, you had one job, and that's what every other team wants to do, and that is get some space on your salary cap, and you took on the entirety of the deal for the next 2 years. It does shock me.
It's just way too much to be spending on Duncan Keith at this point in his career. Way too much. When you look at what good UFA defensemen are going to get in a flat cap world this summer, right, when free agency opens on July 28th, this is way too much to be paying to Duncan Keith right now. If you're going to pay him that much, yeah, to our texter's point, you shouldn't be the one giving assets to Chicago. I will say, I mean, phenomenal job by the Chicago front office, right, to get out of the final 2 years of Duncan Keith's deal and pick up a couple of decent assets in return. You know, I'm not necessarily super high on Caleb Jones, and a third-round pick is a third-round pick. It's a lottery ticket, but still, mm-hmm. You got something, and you didn't have to keep any of that money on your own books. That's a really good piece of business for the Blackhawks, and I don't understand it. Unless Ken Holland and the front office brain trust in Edmonton think that, you know, Duncan Keith has the fountain of youth hidden away somewhere, and he's going to turn back the clock 6 or 7 years. I'm not sure this one makes a ton of sense for Edmonton.
I mean, I guess you're assuming that Evan Bouchard and Broberg are going to be NHL players next year, everyday regular NHL players, which they haven't shown in their careers. Like, I don't, and you're going to get them on, you know, slight deals, I guess, to take some, but there's still so much more work that Edmund has to do. I still don't get it. These texts are coming in. These are awesome. Haha, I can't stop laughing. Stupid Oilers. Holland just did his best Benning impression, and he flat out nailed it. That's from Minor Matt in Abbotsford. Marcus in Gibson's, is Peter Chiarelli still the GM of Edmonton? This deal sure feels like it. It does. It does feel like a Peter Chiarelli move for when he was general manager of the Oilers. I'm confounded. Like, people have been asking, what do you think of the deal? Duncan Keith if you just look at Duncan Keith as the player and where he fits, is he on the second pairing with Adam Larson? Yes, that's probably likely where they're going to slot him in. But how many minutes of a game does he have left? He was playing still a ton in Chicago. You could talk about a bad goaltender. You could talk about a bad team. I mean, they overachieved to a point in the season, Jamie, but I think they hit that wall of, you know, just where they were in the rebuild, and he wants out, and they're, it just, if I look at this, I just think, okay, I'm okay with the player just on your roster. Caleb Jones, yes, as one of our listeners texts out, he was probably could have been lost in the expansion draft. He was in and out of the roster last year. Still a young guy, though, but it's that third-round pick, and it's the cap, not having Chicago, holding Chicago's feet to the fire to have some of that cap retained. Like, it just, to me, seems like a fail from Ken Holland.
And it's a good point by the texter, right, that, listen, they were probably going to lose Caleb Jones anyways. At the very least, they are going to have to expose him, and he would have been an enticing pick for Seattle. That's a fair point. But then the question is, well, couldn't you have found a better way to use that cap space than bringing in Duncan Keith, right? Like, I get it. Maybe you're saying goodbye to Caleb Jones anyways, so you don't feel too bad about giving him up. This problem is still spending that much money on Duncan Keith for the next couple of years. That's the real hang-up for me. We got a text here in Calgary, 960-960. Is this trade from 2014? It doesn't make sense for the oil. And then we got another. This is such a bad trade that I feel bad for Oilers fans as a Flames fan. And then he says, actually, wait a second. No, I don't feel bad. So in Calgary, they're feeling pretty good about this deal.
This Keith move has Benning's name all over it. This texter says, thank goodness Edmonton beat us to the bunch. Yeah, it does a little bit there. There is some news coming out of Canucks camp today. And, well, more rumors, Jamie, shall we say.
Yes.
Elliot Friedman was on with the show and Rick Dhaliwal and Donnie and Dhaliwal in Vancouver. And he talked about, they asked him about the Elias Pettersson and the Quinn Hughes contracts. And you and I had discussed this when we were talking about what our ideal off seasons look like for both the Canucks and Flames. And, you know, the biggest check mark or one of the biggest things that Jim Benning has to get checked off of his list of things to do is signing Elias Pettersson and Quinn. Comment was, he said, looks like short-term deals for both. Pettersson looks to be like the Matthew Barzal range, which was 3 years, $7 million per year. And it's a hard number, he says, to nail down for Quinn Hughes right now. 3 years, $7 million is what Matthew Barzal gets. Is that the direction that Jim Benning and the Elias Pettersson camp, or you could look at it from both sides, Jamie, which direction should they be going? Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, the Barzal comp, I think, has been a really good one. Just based on their production, you know, the pedigree coming into the league as first-round picks, the immediate success at the center ice position. It would have been very surprising to me to see Elias Pettersson come in significantly higher than Matt Barzal, right? Assuming he wasn't going to take a long-term deal, which, you know, everything we've heard for a while now has suggested, no, we're going to see shorter deals for both Pettersson and Hughes. So, you know, I'm curious to hear what Canucks fans think about that. But just for context, Barzal's second contract was 3 years at a $7 million AAV. So, you know, Friedman's not reporting that's going to be the exact deal, but I would think 3 years at somewhere between 7 and 7.5 is what we're going to see for Elias Pettersson. And I think you look at least in the short term, the Canucks number for Pettersson, right? Because you remember, Karen, you know, go back a year in the past and people started, when we were starting to speculate about what the next deals for Pettersson and Hughes could look like people were worried that Pettersson was going to be commanding $10 million, right? So to get it down from that point to 7, 7.5, that's a real important savings for the Canucks in the short term. Now, I'm sure some people will say, you know, 3 years, then he can take that qualifying offer potentially. And does this help him get to UFA a little faster than the Canucks would like? Look, I'm willing to live with that risk. If it is 3 by 7, 3 by 7.5, I think that's a good deal for the Canucks on Elias Pettersson.
And it gives us some flexibility, too, not to have that double-digit number going forward in a flat cap era, especially just in this next season, right? At least I think so, Jamie. Like, you just have to be so financially cautious right now in how you build your team. I would just like to point out, too, that Elliot Friedman did also say on Nate Schmidt, Canucks are considering moving him, he says. We know that. That was out there in the 31 Thoughts podcast. His name is out there. Vancouver will try to make the move. He also says that... with Schmidt and the uncertainty with him, also Alex Edler, Travis Hamonic. I mean, those two, of course, going to hitting free agency on July 27th. The Canucks are looking for a defenseman and a center with size for a third line. And I think those were two things that you and I both had also put on the list of things that the Vancouver Canucks and Jim Benning have to do this offseason to make it a successful or ideal offseason.
Yeah, and it's interesting on defense because they need a top four defenseman anyways. If they trade Nate Schmidt, then they need two. And, you know, Travis Hamonic and Alex Edler, good players, good careers. They're not top four defensemen anymore, right? Those aren't solutions in the top four that your fans can get excited about that are really going to move the needle for your team. So if they are considering moving Nate Schmidt, and if that does come to fruition, I mean, that's two major, major holes on your blue line that you still need to fill. You know, just tying the Nate Schmidt situation and the Duncan Keith trade together, Langley Fun Guy texted in a little bit earlier, says, I think this is a great trade for the Canucks because they are holding Nate Schmidt and looking at this like, can we not get more than this for Nate? Edmonton's at the trade market right now very, very high. That's from Langley Fun Guy. You'd like to think so. The difference is, you know, Nate Schmidt doesn't have the same pedigree as Duncan Keith. And whatever you think about Duncan Keith as a player now, we know how the NHL operates. Right. And we know that there are a lot of general managers that put a lot of stock in the kind of accomplishments that Duncan Keith has on his resume. So I agree with you, Langley Fun Guy. Just from the outside looking in, this should bode well for being able to trade Nate Schmidt, for not having to retain salary if you do decide to trade Schmidt. But we also know general managers in the NHL, man, they just love those championship-winning veterans. They love that. They can't get enough of it. I'm not sure if Nate Schmidt's going to attract the same kind of attention, unfortunately.
As a Flames fan, the Oilers deal is just as bad as when the Flames signed Jágr. Both players are the total opposite of a good bottle of wine, and they're not getting better with age. That one comes unsigned from Calgary. The Oilers are getting roasted by this in the inbox.
This is way worse than signing Jágr. Who cares? You signed Jágr. It didn't work out. It was his last stint in the NHL. He was a good player the year before. This is much, much worse than giving Jaromir Jágr a shot.
In a flat cap era, Jamie, in a flat cap era, they didn't get any salary retained. I can't wrap my head around this. I got to hear what Ken Holland has to say. I can't. Talking about Nate Schmidt quickly, he's got 4 years left on his deal, $5.95 million per his actual base salary, $6 million cap hit, $5.95 million. And you know what? If you're going to sell him to another team, and he's got a modified no trade, so he can submit a 10-team no trade list. Like, if you're looking at selling him to another team, you basically say he's not the player he was last year in Vancouver. It was just a bad year, COVID situation, really weird year. Like, he moved to the city, and you moved to this beautiful city. You don't even get to experience it, right? Like, you're stuck in your house with all these COVID protocols, and I get it was hard for a lot of people, but obviously coming to a new team has to be even harder. It's not the team that was in the bubble that you expected, so if you're going to Jim Benning and you're selling him, like, you're selling the Nate Schmidt that played in Vegas 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, you are, and it's going to be really interesting with Nate Schmidt, with a lot of different players around the league, like, how much weight does that argument hold? Because there's a lot of players you could make that case for, you know? Hey, we just got a throw out last season, it was so weird, you can't really draw any conclusions from it. That is what the Canucks are going to be selling on Nate Schmidt, even though, you know, I didn't think he was all that bad for the Canucks last year. I thought he had some pretty good moments, but that's what you're trying to convince people of, that, hey, this is the guy, you're getting the guy you saw in Vegas, not the guy you saw in Vancouver. And I just got to say, Karen, we're getting like an amazing amount of, you know, crying, laughing emojis into the text box right now. A lot of people having fun at the Edmonton Oilers expense. I enjoy this one also from Marcus and Gibson. Says maybe the Canucks can send Jay Beagle to Edmonton. That's another champion and leader. Right. If they're in the market for some veteran presence, maybe they take Jay Beagle off Jim Benning's hands.
Stop it. I don't want to hear that. It just seems... my goodness, I can't even wrap my head around this right now. It's Duncan Keith equals Chris Pronger. That's a pretty good one. I guess you got to see. Like, look, he's coming to a system where... Yeah, I know you have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, and they drive the offensive side of things, but Dave Tippett does tend to try and play a bit more defensive structured system. That was why he was kind of brought in to lead this Oilers team. The team has been better defensively under him, but again, still not great. That's always been their weakness. Again, it's just an age guy that's... I can't wrap my head around this, Jamie. I'm not sure what to do, but we'll just have
another,
to see.
Another text from the Calgary inbox, 960-960, says, why spend $5.5 million to help McDavid when you can spend it on the hope that Duncan Keith isn't as washed up as literally everyone else says he is? And yeah, that's the hope, right? That all the people here pointing out, saying that, yeah, Duncan Keith's not that effective anymore, but they're missing something, that you change his role a little bit, that you can recapture some of that magic, but... Man, I'd feel a lot better making that bet at, you know, $2.5 million than at $5.5 million.
Yes, considering all the upgrades that you need to make, you need probably another defenseman. You need a top six winger. You need to revamp a bit of your bottom six lineup as well, similar to what the Vancouver Canucks have to do. Like, it's like, I'm sorry, there's a lot of things that Ken Holland has to do, and going after Duncan Keith at a 5.5, 5.6 cap hit just doesn't really feel like it's the right thing to do right now.
No, and that's the thing. There's always, especially in the flat cap, like in a hard salary cap system, this is always the case, but especially now, there's always two questions, right? It's the, what can the player do on the ice? And then, is it worth it based on what you're paying them? And I think, you know, it's fair to have a debate about what Duncan Keith can still bring on the ice. I understand there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic about it, but, you know, if you squint, I can imagine saying, okay, if we put him in exactly the right role, he can help us in these different ways. That's fine. It's just, the chances of him being worth that $5.5 million are so slim, you have to think there was a better way for them to go out and spend this money. Like, there just had to be a better situation. Someone, multiple players that you could give $5.5 million to instead of Duncan Keith.
Langley Fun Guy says, honestly, Keith is going to get 30 points for sure because of the two guys that will be on the power play with him. The one thing I will say about that is it's Darnell Nurse's job on the first unit power play to lose, and probably Duncan Keith, I guess, or Ethan Bear, depending on how they roll out their second power play unit. Keith will not be getting the Tyson Berry treatment that he got early. And I guess we always forget about him, Jamie. Like, we talk about all the defensemen that are going to be out there, and Tyson Berry is what he is. He's not your defensive stalwart, but I guess if you put him in the right situation, which he enjoyed with this Edmonton team, he racked up quite a bit of points, at least early on in the season, and maybe set him up for a decent deal. But we talk about Dougie Hamilton's out there. Seth Jones is prime forward trade. Name some other defensemen. And then you've got, Tyson Berry. We just kind of forget about him.
Yeah, he's definitely, his stock has taken a pretty serious hit since leaving Colorado. Obviously, the year in Toronto didn't work out at all. You know, had a bit of a bounce back season, but still ending in disappointment with the Edmonton Oilers. I like Tyson Berry. Like, I understand he has his limitations. But given the other names that are out there, in particular Dougie Hamilton, who's going to be at the top of the market for UFA defensemen this year, again, in this flat cap world, I think there's a chance that a team gets a pretty decent deal on Tyson Berry when the dust settles.
Mm-hmm. It just depends on like what you're looking for. And if you don't obviously you don't want to overpay for a Tyson Berry, which I guess you could think maybe Toronto did. I know Nazem Kadri needed out, but I don't want to go down the Toronto rabbit hole right now. Some more texts coming in. 650, 650, 960, 960. Hey, Edmonton, I have a great deal on a slightly used Swede who was a previous 30-goal scorer. Hey, maybe Louis Erickson's on his way to the
You can just imagine like every other NHL general manager right now picking up and dialing Ken Holland's number. Like, hey, man, I've got this veteran. I think would be perfect for you guys.
Yeah, you know what? You can have him. You can have his entirety of his salary. We'll give it to you. You know, you may have to throw a pick in here, Wade, but we'll just give it to you, see what they could do. I never thought Ken Holland of someone that would get fleeced. This seems like a fleecing. It is.
It doesn't seem great. It really doesn't seem great. I'll be honest. I mean, man, it's hard to wrap my mind around it. At that cap hit, giving up assets. Again, whatever you think of, where Caleb Jones sat in relation to the expansion draft and a third round pick, no matter how you value those, you're still giving up tangible assets for a player that just, I don't see any way he's worth his contract in the next couple of years.
Hey, Greg, we have that clip from Mark Spector, who joined our show earlier on the day, just before this actually news was broken. Actually, Elliot Friedman called him, probably to tell him about this as we were speaking with Mark Spector. But he talks about, the deal for between Edmonton and Chicago and the holdup. And if we can just play that right before we get to break, Greg, that'd be great.
I don't think Stan Bowman has a second team to trade Duncan Keith to. I think he's got a player who's asked for a trade, a player who, after what he's given to the Blackhawks organization, after the number he took, 5.5 million is a lot for Duncan Keith today, you might say, but for the majority of that contract, he's been a heck of a buy for the Chicago Blackhawks, right? This guy might be a Hall of Fame defenseman. He's won 3 cups there. He'll certainly be on their Ring of Honor or whatever they call it. So Stan Bowman has to trade this player. The player wants to go to one of 4 towns: Vancouver, Calgary, Seattle, or Edmonton. Vancouver's not taking them. Calgary has 4 defensemen making over $4.5 million, I believe. Or is it $4 million, one of the two? Plus an aging Mark Giordano, who's their highest paid defenseman. So they don't need a 38-year-old guy making 5. So I think Stan Bowman has one team to trade Duncan Keith to. And I know that he's asked, Elliot Friedman reported the other day, he was asking for Ryan Malone or Ethan Bear in return. And if I'm Ken Holland in Edmonton, I'm here to tell you, I'm taking this player you have to get rid of. He's making 5.5. I want the player because Duncan Keith can still play. And Edmonton, with Oscar Klefbom being hurt, they're dying for a second-pairing left defenseman here to play with Adam Larson. So Keith's a nice fit in Edmonton, but it's all about the return. It's all about what you have to give to the Blackhawks and who's retaining salary and what's going on there. So I suspect that Ken Holland has put his offer in Stan Bowman's hands last week, and I suspect Stan Bowman fished around looking for a better deal somewhere else and can't find it, and I suspect he'll be coming back to Edmonton pretty quickly, and you're trying to make the deal a little better on his end, but we're going to have a yay or nay on this thing pretty quick, in my opinion.
So we do. Yay or nay. It's a yay deal. Good to go. I find it funny, Jamie, how the last words basically out of his mouth there or towards the end of that conversation were, it's all about the return and it's all about salary retention.
Yeah. And then the salary retention, just not there. Not, you needed that piece of the deal. to make this make sense, and it's just not there.
One final break in our show today. Get your text back in. We'll read some more on the other side. Jamie, there's some pretty clever texts that are coming in for this deal for Duncan Keith to the Oilers. No salary retained. Hey, be a GM. Make a creative trade. What would you call Ken Holland about who you want off your team right now? An old aging player who has a lot of salary? Yeah, let's make it work. Make a deal for you. You are listening to Rintel and Sermon right here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Unbelievable. Nobody can beat us. Back-to-back years. You know, it's an unreal team. Everybody would play hard. You know, I wish we could keep everybody, but that's business. You know, but you know, as of right now, let's party hard. Let's enjoy it. You know, we deserve it.
And in Tampa, there's a boat parade. No regular parades. We get on boats. How do you like that?
Unreal. I think nobody else has done that before. It's unreal. Look how many people here, how many people on the boat. It's just unreal.
Now, my only question is, has Nikita Kucherov or anybody from the Tampa Bay Lightning pulled a Tom Brady, Jamie, and thrown the Stanley Cup to another boat? We talked about this on Friday with Scott and myself, and this is Rintel and Sermon. Scott will be back tomorrow. Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott for the next half an hour as our show comes to an end. But have we seen any pictures of that? Have you seen that been floating around? Or is it just a lot of negativity towards Edmonton Oilers getting Duncan Keith for Caleb Jones, a third, and no salary retention? Which one are you seeing out there?
Yeah, it's a lot more Duncan on the Edmonton Oilers right now. Like, the Tampa Bay Lightning they've fallen completely off the map of the NHL fan discourse right now, because there are so many people having fun at the Edmonton Oilers' expense. It's interesting the idea of trying to throw the Stanley Cup between boats, right?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine they thought about it. I think it's just too difficult. You know, like, it's so big. Yeah. It's unwieldy. I think you would have to do it like a hammer throw situation. You know what I mean? Where you hold it out, you stretch out your arms and kind of spin around and build up some momentum.
Because that's not going to go bad. Nothing's going
to
go wrong with that.
Try that. Like, who has the guts to try that in a public setting? I don't know. I don't think anyone does.
Well, Nikita Kucherov, as you heard in that clip, that was him coming off the top there. He appears to have not stopped since they won the Stanley Cup. He appears to have kept going. We said, remember those shirts were going to be made? Well, those shirts have been made with the BS clip on that. He was seen this weekend. We saw him boating around with both the Super Bowl trophy and the Stanley Cup. Like, they are taking full advantage of Tampa Bay right now.
Oh, yeah. They're living up. Yeah, and plus, we should talk about the shirts that Cooch and Vasilevskiy are
rocking. The number one BS,
first,
what it is?
Well, first we saw on the weekend that Kucherov had the $18 million over the cap t-shirt made up, which is fantastic. I love that. And then, yeah, him and Vasilevskiy also have number one BS, although with the full expression spelled out shirts that they're putting on now. So I love it. They're getting their merch out there. They got the Bud Light sponsorship. Like, they are living it up.
Did I see over the weekend that Vasilevskiy's also re-signed or also signed on with Bud Light? Like, is that a thing, the both of the Russians they've got under contract now?
I didn't see it. It certainly wouldn't surprise me if that was the case.
Loving life there in Tampa Bay. Just want to remind our listeners that NHL draft coverage on Sportsnet Radio is brought to you by Connect Hearing. Take control of your hearing health and book your free hearing test at connecthearing.ca today. We've been talking about it all day, Jamie, and we were basically talking about the fact that, okay, now starts the fun, right? And the fun basically just got underway. We saw the Victor Arvidsson deal. That deal seems like a lifetime ago for the Nashville Predators and the LA Kings. And then rumors were kind of getting out there about the fact that, okay, Tarasenko wants a trade. Seth Jones, well, we've known for a while that he's not going to re-sign a contract in Columbus, wants to test free agency. What other rumors? Nate Schmidt, he's not happy in Vancouver. Then there's the Duncan Keith wants to head west. The deal finally went down today. It's Duncan Keith to Edmonton from the Chicago Blackhawks. They get Caleb Jones in return and a third-round pick. No salary retention. You have to wonder if getting Caleb Jones was important for them because they wanted to try and get Seth Jones out of Columbus as well. The two brothers playing together for the first time in their career. But the Edmonton Oilers, yes, are taking a lot of flack in our inbox and on Twitter. Do you have Ken Holland's phone number? I got a giant box of ripe avocados I need to get rid of. That's from Mike in Tawasin. Like, this is the level that we've gone to with this deal.
It's not getting rave reviews. Not getting rave reviews. Let's put it this way. Another text unsigned to our 650-650 text message inbox. And I want to read this because I think it's an interesting point. He says, the deal in Edmonton is bad, but the Oilers needed veteran leadership with rings and cups. How much is that worth? And look, I'm not going to say that it's worth nothing. I can understand the idea that, hey, we need to bring someone in with a winning pedigree who can play a certain role in our locker room. The problem is, as we've seen here in Vancouver with the Vancouver Canucks, you can get yourself in a really bad cap position by overpaying for that idea of leadership, right? Like, that was the theory with bringing in Jay Beagle. Is that, hey, this guy is a Stanley Cup winner. He is going to transform our locker room, our culture, basically. But they're paying him way too much money. And that's the concern here. Yeah, could there be value in bringing in a guy who's won a Stanley Cup to help the young talent in Edmonton along? Sure, I'm open to that idea. But you can't give up some good assets and pay $5.5 million if the thing you're hanging your hat on for that player is always veteran leadership. You have to be able to find that at a bargain if you're going to go out and prioritize it.
So I'm reading an article on sportsnet.ca right now, and it's done by the Sports Logic staff, Jamie. And, a lot of analytical stuff that is in this article. And, you know, first off, it says the first sentence, can Duncan Keith still play? Yes. Yes, he can. But then it goes into some of the other numbers of Duncan Keith, and they were pretty bad last year. Like, he's got some numbers where if you're looking to bring on a defenseman who you think is aging and going in the wrong direction, and you're looking at analytics, well, they don't really back up your case for bringing in that defenseman. The only thing that could be said is if Duncan Keith is brought in and put into a situation with this Oilers team where he's not the number one pairing like he was in Chicago, he's not eating all those minutes on a youthful Chicago Blackhawks team, can he be put in more in a role that's more beneficial for someone that is 37, will start the season at 38 years old?
Yeah, that's the question, and that is what everything hinges on here, right? Is that reducing his minutes significantly increases how effective he is in those minutes. It's not a crazy idea. Like, that's something we see, right? You know, a player, if they just get in a slightly easier role, they're able to be much more effective in that role. That can happen. I just still think the odds of it happening such that you're happy you're paying Duncan Keith $5.5 million are very, very slim.
Can Benning call Stan Bowman and ask how to fleece somebody for some of his bad contracts? That's Mike in Victoria. Someone also made the note that, yes, someone's leaf blower is running. Yes, my daily. Actually, it happens 3 times a week, Jamie. My lawn crew is here fixing my condo unit, so I apologize if you hear it in the background. It's the joys of working from home these days. It's just, you know, looking at these deals, and they're going to start coming in fast and furious. And the one thing that you look at if you're the Oilers, and maybe this is what we talked about it earlier, maybe this is what Darryl Cates is looking out. Like, Ken Holland, you can deal with the cap hit, but real money is $3.6 million versus what the actual cap hit is. And when we were looking at Vladimir Tarasenko, the one downside that he has in a economy where these owners did not make very much money last season is, yeah, his cap hit is 7.5 mil, but the real money he is owed this year is $9.5 million. So, I don't know. Maybe there's a situation where this is the real money owed is that much more appealing than the actual cap hit for the Oilers?
That seems to be part of it, right? Is like, hey, we're not concerned about the cap hit because we're not actually paying him that much money. You know, you don't want to be cynical, but there's almost the sense of, well, he's going to help us get to the salary cap ceiling, so we won't be able to spend anything more, but we're paying him less on salary, so it works out to us saving a little bit of money. Again, that's pretty cynical, but given the financial realities of a lot of these teams right now, that probably does enter into it. Again, it's just, you can understand that from an owner's perspective, but that doesn't mean as a fan you have to like the deal, right? It's still frustrating that that's part of the motivation for executing the deal.
Hey, Greg, let's get the notes and quotes. So, Jamie, before the day started and Duncan Keith was an Edmonton Oiler and everyone was talking about this, the topic of conversation earlier in the day was the fact that Pierre Maguire is back in the NHL after about, what, 2+ decades of being in the broadcast booth. He's coming back. He is senior VP of player development under Pierre Dorion. And this is funny because when it did originally come out and all the quotes, and Bruce Garriock of the Ottawa Sun had a quote from Pierre, but also all the other quotes were from owner Eugene Melnyk. Pierre Dorion had been pretty quiet on it until they held a press conference, but he did speak on the fact that someone asked him about, does this set up for Maguire to make a bigger role, and are you worried about your job?
When you're a general manager, you bring somebody in with Pierre Maguire's resume to not think this guy could be, you know, my replacement down the road. If that makes sense.
So, Ian, what's the exact question?
Yeah, I know. I kind of rambled there.
I know you're a fairly smart guy, so I just need a concrete question, and then I'll answer as truthfully as I can.
Okay, so let me just boil it down to this. Does Pierre Dorion worry that Pierre Maguire is his replacement?
Not at all. Not at all. I think, and I hope to be here for the long term, and I hope that Pierre Maguire is a part of my team for the long term. We all want ambitious people and people that are driven to work with us. And there's no denying the fact that Pierre is ambitious, he's driven. And I think that only makes us a better team. And it only makes me a better general manager. And the one thing is I never worry about my contract. If you start worrying about your contract and what decisions you're going to make, then you're not helping the organization. I've always said that as far as this plan, I knew where we'd be year after year after year. I felt that we've made good additions, through the draft, some through free agency. We made some really good trades. And a lot of them were trades that moved out veteran players for guys that came in and, they're our core now. So obviously, Ian, I'm not worried at all about my situation. Eugene knows my I did my last contract, and he can contact me.
First of all, my first thought, Jamie, is that's a pretty ballsy question to ask.
Yeah.
I would definitely not have the guts to do it.
That's a great question, and look, we've had Ian on the show on a couple of times. He's fantastic at covering the Senators, and as you heard Pierre Dorion say there, he's a smart guy. You know what he's getting at, but respect for asking the question, and respect to Pierre Dorion for answering it head on as well. It gets to the underlying dynamic that's always there with the Ottawa Senators, right? Mm-hmm. And we talked about it a little bit with Mark Spector earlier in the show as well, but you just, even when they take two steps forward, you're just kind of waiting for Eugene Melnyk to rear his head again and do something that disrupts the franchise. And we don't know if this decision is that move, but again, you read the tea leaves and it seems like this was driven by Melnyk, not by Dorion going out and wanting to hire Pierre Maguire. And that should make people nervous in Ottawa, because typically the more involved that Eugene Melnyk is in hockey operations, the worse it is for the Ottawa Senators.
Yeah, it seemed like we hadn't heard from him in a while, and that's a good thing. If you don't hear from Eugene Melnyk, it means, okay, he's letting Pierre Dorion do his thing. He's letting him be just run the team. Eugene, deal with whatever else you're dealing with in the background. We all know the other legal issues that he has to deal with, but it strikes me as an odd time to bring in Pierre Maguire. He has not been in the league for a very long time. How he sees the NHL versus how he saw it the last time he was in the NHL, I don't know how they mix, because there is the one thing that's become a lot more prevalent in the NHL, Jamie, since Pierre Maguire was left in it, and that is analytics. And he was asked the question about analytics, and he says, you know what, I don't hate them.
It's not that I hate analytics, but I believe in scouting. I believe that there has to be people that are boots on the ground, hardcore hockey people that you can actually evaluate a player without utilizing numbers, and the player passes the eye test. I still don't know if there's an analytic equation for heart, for character, for hard work, for fearlessness, for determination. So that's part of the formula that hardcore boots on the ground scouting has to be. I don't hate analytics. I think it's a tool that can be utilized in any kind of evaluation, but I'm a big believer in boots on the ground scouting, and I'll use Tampa Bay as an example. If you look at, and I won't talk about players, obviously, because it's a sensitive issue now, but if you look at Tampa, salute them as a Stanley Cup champion, but look at the depth players that Tampa had and the way they performed. It was phenomenal to watch, Ian. It really was.
So, Jamie, the analytics crew must love hearing that if you're an Ottawa Senators fan.
Well, it was kind of an inevitable question because Pierre Maguire, you know, he's spent a lot of time on various broadcasts over the year bashing the idea of ever using numbers to help you evaluate players. And, you know, he kind of gave a boilerplate answer there. Well, it's just one tool, but other tools are important, too. But then he kind of goes on to make it sound like he really doesn't believe it's that important of a tool. And, you know, I don't want to make this all about Pierre Maguire. The thing is, Pierre Maguire is not the only person in hockey who thinks that, right? Like, there's lots of people, probably in every front office in the NHL, who think that way. And I just think it's kind of remarkable that the NHL is still in this place where you feel like you have to pick sides between scouting and analytics, right? Like, if you look at other sports that are maybe a little farther ahead on the curve than hockey, like, you look at the NBA, you look at Major League Baseball, there are very few people there that say they either don't believe in analytics or don't believe in scouting. Like, most people in those sports understand that you can use both tools effectively together and that they complement each other rather than replacing each other. And again, it's not just about Pierre Maguire. He's just the latest guy saying something like this. But I wonder when hockey is going to get to that point as a whole, as an industry, as a league, where it's not about pitting scouting and advanced analytics against each other. It's about recognizing that, hey, if you're going to be a good front office, if you're going to be a smart team making smart decisions, you need to use both of those to their fullest potential.
Isn't it age thing too, Jamie? And I don't mean that in like ageism, but it just seems like a lot of the, like, Pierre Maguire's of the older, old school guy, Ken Holland. Like, the Edmonton Oilers have one of the smaller, I think they have one guy who's an analytics guy on their team, and analytics don't point towards Duncan Keith, right? Like, but you've got these new ingenuitive, you know, front offices, some that are maybe skewed a little too heavily towards analytics, depending on who you ask. But I do wonder if it's like that Hollins of the Maguire generation, right? Like, the old school guy that does believe in getting boots on the ground.
Yeah, and I mean, I think older hockey guys, like, there's nothing stopping them from embracing analytics to a certain degree, right? And I think certainly, again, across sports, you've seen examples of, you know, guys who have been in the industry for a long time who are comfortable using different newer ways and lenses of looking at players and evaluating players. So I think it's certainly possible, but it does seem like in hockey, for whatever reason, there is more resistance to, you know, not just paying lip service to the idea, oh yeah, well, they're a tool, you know, we have these great analytics guys, but actually embracing them and making it a real part of your decision-making process.
So we've reached the point of the summer. Jamie, I'm actually kind of happy that we have a lot of stuff going on with respect to the NHL, because there's really nothing going on too much anymore. We had the Euro wrap-up yesterday. Congratulations to Italy. Not congratulations to my stomach at some point later on this month. You've got Wimbledon just wrapping up. Do have the British, the Open Championship over in England. I guess we could talk about a little bit later on this week. Some players not there because of COVID-19 testing and protocols, so that's disappointing. But we do have tonight the All-Star, well, that's tomorrow, sorry. The All-Star Games tomorrow, the Midsummer Classic, and we've got the Home Run Derby tonight. You've got Shohei Ohtani putting his skills on display in the thin air in Coors Field. You will be watching. What are you most intrigued about watching of tonight's Home Run Derby?
Oh, I mean, well, obviously it's Shohei Ohtani, right? And just wondering if he can possibly live up to the hype. Because, hey, I'm guilty of it. I've been hyping him up all show here. But the expectations for what he can do tonight are off the charts. People are expecting a truly, truly memorable performance from Shohei Ohtani tonight. So I hope he lives up to it. I will say, I mean, it's at Coors Field, and we know that they're not going to be using the humidor on the baseballs, so that they're doing everything they can to facilitate these guys putting on a show, right? They are going to make this as a hitter-friendly an environment as possible. So I want to see as many home runs as possible, and I want to see some distance behind these. I want to see someone crack 500 feet at Coors Field tonight.
Hey, Greg, jump in quickly. You're a big baseball guy. Are you excited for this this Home Run Derby tonight? Any underrated story you're looking at, or is it just the Shohei Ohtani show?
Yeah, I don't think there's any underlying stories that you can really get from a Home Run Derby, but who doesn't enjoy watching?
Come on! Trey Mancini, coming back from
cancer. But it's a home run. Even if you win it, is it really that big of an accomplishment? I think it's just fun to watch big sluggers go up there and take their hacks, and I think everyone can enjoy that. I don't think you could read into it that much deeper than it already is.
Okay, I won't. I won't try and find the underlying good stories. Trevor Story's playing at home. Pete Alonso's trying to go for back-to-back if you want to try and find any other stories to root for. But yes, it is the Shohei Ohtani's night, and we're all looking forward to it. Jamie, basketball, we didn't even talk about this. Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Quickly get a note in on this. Giannis Antetokounmpo, 41 points, plus 10 rebounds. The guy was on fire yesterday. The Milwaukee Bucks made it a series. That's the one thing I wanted. Like, I tried to get myself into this series. I think I've watched, like, 5 minutes of each game. Like, it's just, there's no compelling storyline for me, but it is nice to know that it's not a 3-0 sweep. It's the Bucks. You know, so far, the home team hasn't lost, and it's not a series until the home team loses. So we'll see what happens. Yeah, but I think it's nice.
We've got a series. It's great. Of course, you don't want to see it be a sweep, right? And I get why there's not as much hype around the finals. I do still think it's pretty interesting seeing Chris Paul trying to finally get the ring, seeing if Giannis can get the ring as a two-time MVP. They made it a series, and you can even, because of how good Giannis has been in the last two games, back-to-back 40-point performances for him, you know the blueprint for Milwaukee to not only even this series up, but to go on and win the series potentially. They don't have an answer for Giannis right now. And unless that changes, you kind of like Milwaukee's chances here.
And just to point out, too, I believe Milwaukee was down 0-2 in all of their series, if I'm not mistaken, except for maybe the first one. But they were down 0-2 against the Nets. Everyone thought that was going to be a runaway. They came back, won that one in seven. Let's just see what happens in game four, what Giannis can do, what Monty Williams can drop on the defensive side of the ball. Jamie, thank you. It's been a fun show today. A lot of topics of conversation. You got to share in my England misery. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you got one day of distance before Rintoul comes back and has a parade in Italy's honor. It's on the show tomorrow.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Can't you hear the excitement in my voice? Well, Shohei Ohtani was on. It will be on display tonight, but always, we always say, you are the Shohei Ohtani of the show. So again, I appreciate you stepping in for Scotty. Big ups to Greg Ballack back in Mission Control. Raja Shurgal producing a very excellent show today. Thank you, Raja. Right on the eastern side of the Rockies, we're going to turn things over, as always, to the big show. It's Bick and the Boss in Vancouver. Have a great afternoon, everyone. Scott, we'll be back tomorrow. We'll talk to you then.